Up front next, Joe Biden about to go head-to-head with Elizabeth Warren for the first time as the most important debate so far is about to start. And tonight, the new details about Biden's plan of attack. Plus, the president's national security advisor, one of the most important jobs in the entire country. Yet the president now says it's just really easy because of him. And the man President Trump once called my African-American, remember at that rally? He's now quitting the Republican Party. Why now? Well, he's out front. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the high-stakes showdown. This is the third Democratic debate about to begin for the first time. Joe Biden facing off against Elizabeth Warren. The front runner versus the leading liberal. And for both, this is a pivotal evening. Now, Warren has been chipping away at Biden's lead, steadily rising. Now only 6 points separate the two, according to our newest poll. Team Biden revealing new details tonight about the former VP's strategy. He knows tonight is crucial. He wants to attack Warren's plans and build upon his former boss's record, which was the focus of a new ad.
I think we should step back and say something we don't often say enough as a party or as a nation. Barack Obama is an extraordinary man.
He wants to emphasize that relationship. And another man paying very close attention to the debate is President Trump. He spoke just a couple moments ago about who he thinks will be the person he faces off against in 2020.
He should be able to make it. I would imagine Biden would be able to make it if he doesn't make any major mistakes.
If he doesn't make any major mistakes. Jessica Dean is out front live in Houston with me. So, Jessica, what more are you learning about Biden's strategy for tonight? He knows it is crucial he not make any big mistakes.
That's certainly true, Erin, but the campaign also downplaying this head-to-head matchup between Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, saying, look, there are 10 candidates on this stage. The former vice president is going to run his race. He's going to do what he's there to do. And there, his advisors are saying that's make this case that we need more than plans, but action to make progressive change. They're going to use health care as an example of that. Biden going to make the case that building upon the Affordable Care Act is the quickest and best way to ensure as many people as possible, as opposed to Medicare for All, which would be a complete overhaul of the system. So that's what he's going to try to do tonight. You also saw that new ad that came out today, closely aligning that relationship with President Obama. And look, Erin, there are numbers that support that. In the new CBS News poll, when voters were asked what really draws you to vote for Vice President Joe Biden as the nominee, 87% of people in that poll said his time as vice president with President Barack Obama. So they know that that's a number that's important to them. They know that that's something they can go back to again and again. You can expect him to talk about the Obama record and really defend it. But Erin, it'll be really interesting to see everybody on the stage tonight. Again, Biden and Warren have sparred before over a bankruptcy bill back in 2005. They have a history of kind of going back and forth on this. And again, as they try to downplay this head-to-head matchup, they're also coming out saying our key thing tonight is we need more than just plans. We need action. So, Erin, we'll see what happens tonight.
All right. Thank you very much, Jessica. Now let's go out front to Karen Dunn. She prepared President Obama and Hillary Clinton for political debates. Dana Bash is our chief political correspondent, and Jeff Zeleny is our senior Washington correspondent, all in Houston with me tonight. So, Dana, I mean, look, there's drama. Biden and Warren have never been together on a debate stage tonight, and now here they are for the first time this evening. They've got a long and complicated history, and we know that Biden is going to say it's not just about plans, it's about execution. So is she going to return the fire?
It's hard to imagine that she will. That certainly has not been her MO to date. Her whole campaign is based upon the fact that she has plans, she has ideas, let's get out and fight and work for them, and not I'm going to, you know, go after anybody no matter who they are. That could change. He could sort of provoke her in a way that we don't expect. But it doesn't seem like that is her style to do that, no matter who it is that she's with, for lots of reasons. Again, that's just not who she is. It's not like she can't debate. I can't remember, one of the stories this morning said that she was a master debater since she was a little kid. So she knows how to do this. When there is somebody who she's really trying to make a point against, she can potentially do it without being as aggressive as we've seen in the past.
Well, it's funny. It fits with her MO that she's been debating since she's 6 years old.
Of course.
It does. That's, you know, it's not jarring. It's completely consistent.
I agree with Adana. I think she has never come to the debate to land a punch. But I will say this. If Joe Biden is coming to talk about Elizabeth Warren's plans, there's going to be two people on that stage there to talk about Elizabeth Warren's plans. And so the real question is she going to counterpunch if Biden goes after her first?
Right. And I mean, you know, I recall last time, you know, when she said, look, why are we going to talk about what we can't do and instead talk about what we can do? And it was a very powerful moment. It got a lot of applause. I mean, is it possible she just does something like that?
Yes.
You know, stop saying, let's just be safe, you know, right?
And, yeah. I mean, so far her program has worked very well for her. There's really no reason she shouldn't stick to her program. And it'll be a very interesting dynamic because Joe Biden is there to talk about Elizabeth Warren's plans. She's there to talk about her plans. And potentially everyone else on the stage is there to talk about one of Joe Biden or Donald Trump. And so we'll see if anybody actually engages in a conversation with another person on the stage.
I love it when you're able to summarize it so well, which I know this is how you think of it strategically. But that is a really... a succinct way to lay it down. So, Jeff, look, Biden's plan also includes, as he put out, right, to focus on Obama, right, who, you know, has been staying out of the fray. But Biden tweeted today, Barack Obama was a great president. We don't say that enough. And he put that new video out that I was showing. It's almost entirely about his relationship with Obama. So is that smart?
Well, look, if you're Joe Biden, of course it's smart. He said, we don't say it enough. Well, Joe Biden says it all the time. When you go to campaign rallies, town meetings, other things that Joe Biden has, Barack Obama is a central and recurring theme in this, as it should be. Of course, it's one of the biggest points on his biography and his resume. But the question here is the party is clearly, without question, moving in a leftward direction. So there is going to be a discussion about the Obama legacy, the Obama record. I would be surprised, just talking to advisors from a lot of candidates, if it's going to be as sharp as it was at the Detroit debate in July. A lot of Democrats got a lot of backlash for going after Barack Obama so much. So I think it's a fine line to walk there. But Joe Biden knows he needs to take it another level beyond simply saying I was Barack Obama's running mate. But Aaron, I am told tonight, just a few moments ago, that Joe Biden's also been doing something else. He's been hitting the books, studying Warren's plans. We've been talking all about those plans. Well, in the last several days, I'm told that Joe Biden has been, you know, sort of getting into the weeds on some of those because he needs to be familiar with them if he's going to pick them apart. You know, how realistic are they? How expensive are these plans? So that is a bit of an interesting thing he's not done before. He's been spending some time reading up on one of his rivals.
Well, you know, and Dana, that's really interesting, Jeff's reporting, because, you know, the whole point from Joe Biden has been whatever about the plans, right? I'm the electable one. And you know, we had heard he might be specifically looking at her health care plan.
Exactly.
Which is why I just have to play the Jill Biden soundbite again, because it says so much. And here she is.
Your candidate might be better on, I don't know, health care than Joe is. But you've got to look at who's going to win this election. And maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I sort of personally like so-and-so better. But your bottom line has to be that we have to beat Trump.
Have to be practical. I mean, that boils down the difference between what you're going to hear from Joe Biden tonight and what you're going to hear from Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, for that matter.
Yep.
And that really, it really defines the differences between the major candidates. And it defines the differences for voters on which way they want to go.
Yeah.
You know, yes, Joe Biden has been looking at plans. You know, it wouldn't be surprising if we heard something along the lines of Elizabeth Warren has so many plans, but on health care, she just says she's with Bernie. Is that because she wants to leave herself some wiggle room on the Medicare for All situation, which obviously she says she's all in on, but we don't have details from her, because this is something that if she does keep rising as she has been doing, could potentially hurt her in a general
election.
She's
got to think about the general election.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and on that point, Karen, the Washington Post ABC News poll has Biden leading Trump by 15 points, Sanders by 9, Warren by 7. And that's sort of what Jill Biden is saying, right?
Yes.
She's saying, so what about all of us, the passion and the good plans? Who can win? That seems to be what her job is tonight, right? To show that she can be the electable one. Why do people love her for the plans, but not reward her when it comes to the head-to-head?
So I just don't think she looks at the world that way. I think Elizabeth Warren is here to put forward her vision. It's unchanging. It's been the same. It's authentic to who she is. And when Joe Biden says, who's going to get it done, what he's also saying is, who can go toe-to-toe with President Trump? Who is going to be able to win a general election? He is looking at this from a practical perspective. And I just would be surprised, very surprised, if Elizabeth Warren came at this from a way that she's never come at it before in a debate. So I expect that we will see she's still prosecuting the case about vision. He's prosecuting, as Dana says, a case about practicality. And all of this is overshadowed by the larger question, who can beat the president? And is that a practical question, or is that a question about who has a vision?
And what she has slowly but surely tried to start to argue is she can do both. She can have the vision and go toe-to-toe with the president, that they're not mutually exclusive. And so it's going to be interesting to see if she continues on that path tonight and if she can do it in a more succinct way, especially given the fact that she's finally on the same stage as Joe Biden.
So Jeff Zeleny, does Team Biden, you know, when you hear Trump say, well, he's going to be the nominee unless he makes a major mistake, do they feel that tonight and every one of these debates, but tonight this is the biggest one thus far, do they feel the stakes are so high that he cannot make a mistake?
No, they, of course, would never raise their own expectations. I mean, they are, though, quite high. The reality here is how Joe Biden, performs in the moment will be watched by everyone, most particularly the most important people, by the voters who are trying to make the judgment, as Karen was just talking about. There is no correct answer to who is the most electable candidate now. It's an unknowable thing. Is it, you know, following your head or following your heart? I talked to so many voters who are weighing this. So that's why this is an important debate for Joe Biden. His advisors are saying this is just one of several steps in the nominating fight. But it's, of course, more than that. He needs to keep showing he's the strongest candidate. And he's been uneven over the summer, so we'll see how he does tonight here. But don't forget the other candidates on stage as well, trying to have their big moments, something like 18 more fundraising days in this period. If someone breaks out like a Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, that could be gangbusters for them as well. Aaron.
That's right. And we're going to talk so much more about all those others, because that the fact that they have so much at stake really could change the dynamics tonight. Thank you very much to all of you. And next, President Trump just talking about the search for his new national security advisor. Here's what he said.
It's a lot of fun to work with Donald Trump, and it's very easy, actually, to work with him. You know why it's easy? Because I make all the decisions.
Well, then why would anybody want the job? Plus, a major move by Democrats in their efforts to impeach the president. So why is Nancy Pelosi insisting that nothing has changed? Her, of all people. And then this man. He was singled out by then-candidate Trump in 2016.
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? You know what I'm talking about?
Okay. Well, that man is done with Trump. Why? He's out front.
Aaron Burnett out front. Brought to you by Watchmen. A one-time procedure for people with non-valvular atrial fibrillation.
Tonight, President Trump speaking out about his search for a new national security advisor after firing John Bolton this week.
A lot of people want the job, and it's a great job. It's great because it's a lot of fun to work with Donald Trump, and it's very easy, actually, to work with him. You know why it's easy? Because I make all the decisions and I have to work.
So the president making light of it, although he was also being pretty serious, right, because it's about him making the decisions. But it's not a laughing matter because it is the most powerful national security job in the country. And Trump is now searching for his fourth national security advisor, which is more than Obama, Bush and Clinton had in their entire two terms in the White House. Up front now, Scott Jennings, former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and Keith Boykin, former Clinton White House aide. So, Keith, what do you make? I mean, he's trying to say, he's making it a joke, but, you know, he's doing it in his way. He's also serious, right? Referring to himself in the third person and making the whole point of, well, it's easy because I make all the decisions.
Why would anyone want to work for Donald Trump, period, much less work to be his national security advisor? When he fired the first national security advisor, Michael Flynn, he fired the second national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and now he's fired the third national security advisor, John Bolton. Trump came in office saying he was only going to hire the best people, but he continues to hire people who apparently are not the best people. Then he fires them, and he complains about those people being ineffectual or incapable of doing their jobs. Well, how can you do your job when the president is the one who's making all the decisions? You know, this is not the way in any sort of organizational structure should operate. There's supposed to be a hierarchy. The president makes some decisions, but he's supposed to take advice from people. This guy doesn't take advice from anybody. And he came in office and he said he knows more than the generals. So why should he take advice from anybody? Because he thinks he knows it all.
Scott, does he think that what he said was funny?
Yes, he thinks it's funny. I think he was having fun with that answer, number one. Number two, of course, the president makes all the decisions about national security. The president is the commander-in-chief. The national security advisor is an assistant to the president. It's not confirmed by the Senate. It is a staff job in the White House. It answers to the president. It serves at the pleasure of the president. And they do not make the decisions. The commander-in-chief makes the final call. I think in this instance, the president had decided that Ambassador Bolton and he just weren't on the same page regarding policy and process. And any president is entitled to having advisors around him that he has confidence in and that he believes is giving him the kind of advice that works for his leadership style. So I think a lot is being made about the departure, but ultimately, when two guys aren't on the same page, it's the commander-in-chief that has to make the decision to get the staff that gives him confidence.
I have to say, I completely agree with you on that. I would say, though, John Bolton's positions have been so well-known for so long that the fact that it took Trump this long to figure out that he wasn't on the same page is pretty damning in and of itself. It's not like we didn't know what John Bolton stood for.
He's on Fox News every day. You can see it. He used to be.
Yeah, I think that one thing that he liked about Ambassador Bolton at the outset was his TV persona. You know, John Bolton on television is pretty engaging guy and had a lot of interesting things to say. But it's one thing to be on television, and it's another thing to actually have to run the staff process in a way that satisfied the president inside the White House. And so, look, I think the president's got a lot of good people to choose from to replace Ambassador Bolton. But if you think that somebody's going to come into this job or any other and somehow change Donald Trump or start making all the decisions for Donald Trump, and you don't understand the way this presidency works.
Well, Scott, I think you just made my case for me. I mean, Trump shouldn't be looking at Fox News to pick his people to be on his national security staff or any part of his administration. That's exactly the problem. You just said it. If we had any sort of normal, sane, sensible presidency, we would be looking through who were the best qualified people out there, not just who were the people who were the talking heads on TV who happen to say things that the president likes from time to time. That's not a responsible way to manage things. And yes, they understand the idea that the president makes the ultimate decisions, but the president doesn't know everything. That's the reason why he or she is supposed to take advice from the people who are experts in their field. This guy doesn't do that. You could probably, and I think CNN has already done this, you could roll a tape of all the hundreds of times Donald Trump has said he knows more about this topic or that topic than anybody else does. That's insane. Nobody could possibly know that much, and you know that.
Well, another topic he says he knows a lot about, Scott, today is the report about Israel spying, planting surveillance devices near the White House. He just commented on that. Here's what he said.
I don't believe that. No, I don't think the Israelis were spying on us. I really would find that hard to believe. My relationship with Israel has been great. I wouldn't believe that story. It's good. Anything's possible. But I don't believe it.
Now, Scott, I just want to make it clear. We haven't been able to verify the specific reporting about surveillance devices. But, of course, our allies have, you know, spies, whatever word you want to use, right? I mean, does the president really believe that Israel would not want to know, would not spy?
Well, number one, the last thing he said is the truth. Anything's possible, and things like this do happen. Everybody's spying on everybody, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have an adversarial relationship with that particular country, in this case, Israel. So I think the way the question was presented to the president, perhaps he was thinking it's a question about are they doing it in an adversarial way?
No, of course not.
But the reality is, does he really think
that because his... I'm sorry, I know we have a little bit of a delay, but does he really think it's because his relationship with the country is great, they're not going to spy on him? I mean, he's either playing it so they don't look embarrassed, or he's just utterly naive. Which is it?
Well, I think what I understood the president to be saying is that he didn't think he thought his relationship with Israel was good and they wouldn't be doing anything that was adversarial or that you would expect an enemy country to be doing. But obviously, Israel, the United States, all these countries with these big intelligence services, I mean, everybody's spying on everybody. I think that's pretty well known.
Well, the only sad thing about it is that
you, Scott,
know that and everybody else doesn't know that. The president doesn't know that. I'm sorry, Aaron.
Oh, well, that's okay. No, I'm sorry. I know we have a bit of a delay. Thank you both. And next, Democrats make a major move to clear up confusion about impeachment. Did they just make things better or worse? And President Trump just responding to news that the man he referred to as, quote, my African American, is turning on him.
He's the man that you pointed out at the rally and called my African American.
I don't know. We have tremendous African American support.
He joins me. New tonight, the House Judiciary Committee voting to give Chairman Jerry Nadler the ability to call committee hearings, impeachment hearings. And Chairman Nadler is making it clear he is done playing word games with the whole thing.
Some call this process an impeachment inquiry. Some call it an impeachment investigation. There is no legal difference between these terms, and I no longer care to argue about nomenclature.
Out front now, Democratic Congresswoman from Texas, Sheila Jackson Lee. She sits on the House Judiciary Committee here with me tonight. So Chairman Nadler says this vote means you're going to have an aggressive series of hearings. You're going to go well beyond the four corners of the Mueller report. But the top Republican on your committee, Mr. Collins, Congressman Collins, says the difference between formal impeachment proceedings, I'm quoting him, and what we're doing today is a world apart. Is it?
Well, first of all, you know I'm at Texas Southern University, so let me say how excited I am to be here tonight before the debate. But I love the word game that Ranking Member Collins desires to use. We are serious. This is an impeachment investigation. Let me refresh your memory. The Senate investigated for 9 months before there were actual articles of impeachment. Many investigations, impeachment investigations, proceeded without a vote on the floor of the House. This is the indicting body. What we're saying to the American people is that we are not in a witch hunt. We're not going after an individual. We're fact finders in a constitutional process that is an investigation leading to the articles of impeachment. I want the Republicans to sit with us as Americans in this impeachment investigation, which we will now have the strength of an investigation as we go to court, as we subpoena witnesses to be able to tell the American people truth.
And so on that front, you know, you talk about subpoenaing witnesses, right? So if it is an impeachment proceeding, you're able to do more of that. Are we going to see the main players testify? You know, part of everyone's, what made Watergate was people could see it on television. Are we going to see more of that?
Absolutely. These will be public hearings. You know, we had a few closed sessions for a variety of reasons.
Yes.
But we have a list of individuals now that really have no excuse for not appearing before the Judiciary Committee, and we are using the subpoena power. The White House counsel is one of them who has indicated or said that he's being blocked, or the White House is saying that they're blocked. Now with the impeachment investigation,
Mr. McGahn,
now the impeachment investigation, we're going to expect the court to side with us because we will not be able to find out the facts. We can't talk to him about what the president told him to do with Director Mueller.
Yeah.
We're going to have Corey Lewandowski next week, and we're just going on and on to witnesses that can tell us the story.
All right, so you're talking in some of these cases, Mueller, but perhaps beyond, and that's a big question because I know, you know, Madeleine Dean, she came back and she said, look, what my constituents care about was the corruption, the public profiting from office, that whether the law was broken there by the President of the United States. Is that now as big of a focus as the Mueller report?
The Mueller report, as you well know, was two volumes. One was the Russian intrusion and the involvement of the campaign with Russian operatives. We think that's important. And we believe that as we interview witnesses or have them in hearings, who knows what may be discovered.
I'm just trying to understand, but things like emoluments or, you know, when we look at Mike Pence staying at Turnberry, those sorts of things, profiting from the office of the president, is that part of this or not? Because obviously that's separate from either volume of the
report. It is. But it will not be precluded. Remember, the trigger for the Nixon impeachment were the tapes. When we started out with a burglary,
right. was whether the president right. directed a burglary and then the tapes. In this instance, no, the emoluments will not be precluded, nor will the payments to individuals to keep them silent as it relates to an affair. So this is opening up an impeachment investigation to look at, under the Constitution, the question is high crimes and misdemeanors. That's sometimes confusing to the American people, but it's about abuse of power.
Right. So Chairman Nadler, you know, is saying that you're saying impeachment investigation, impeachment inquiry, saying, look, those are the same things. Okay. But, you know, nomenclature, words matter. Chairman Nadler's fed up with this whole discussion, but part of that's because Nancy Pelosi is not using these words. She doesn't seem to be playing ball. Today she was asked about, okay, are you going to call it impeachment inquiry? We're loud and clear here, and here's what happened.
Are you uncomfortable with the term impeachment inquiry? Is there another term we should be using?
Thank you all very much. You are hung up on a word over here when lives are at stake over there. Thank you all very much, and good morning.
So, look, people are hung up on the word because she won't use the word. Why won't she use the word? Words do matter. Her ability to get behind this matters. What's the holdup?
Well, I think by her yielding to the Judiciary Committee on the words, we now have said that we are through with impeachment inquiry and impeachment investigation debate. It is the impeachment investigation, and the Speaker is allowing the Judiciary Committee to do its work. We think once we get started, the American people will start holding on to the words impeachment investigation. What are they doing? They're investigating under the Constitution to determine whether there be articles of impeachment. I respect the Speaker, and I think her words today, her silence today was, she's not going to get into semantics. Watch what the committee is doing. Watch what the courts will do when we go in and indicate that we're in an impeachment investigation, and watch what the people of the United States will see in what will be a respectful, detailed, and definitive approach to the question of whether or not the president has violated the Constitution of the United States as relates to impeachment.
All right. Congresswoman, thank you so much. Good
thank
to see you here in Texas
me.
Tonight.
Thank you so very much. Thank you for having me.
And next, the man President Trump once called my African American at a rally no longer backs Trump. So what's his response to the president just insisting he has tremendous African American support? And the most important Democratic debate so far is about to take place. So Kamala Harris, what does she need to do to recapture the momentum? Breaking news. President Trump responding now to the news that the man that he called my African American at a 2016 campaign rally no longer supports him. He's changed his mind, no longer for Trump and leaving the Republican Party.
The man that you called my African American at your rally in 2016, he says he's leaving the Republican Party because you're pursuing a pro-white agenda. What's your reaction?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. What?
What do you say to him? What do you say to him? He used to be a supporter of yours.
I don't know who you're talking about.
He's the man that you pointed out at the rally and called my African American.
I don't know. We have tremendous African American support. I would say I'm at my all-time high. I don't think I've ever had the support that I've had now.
Trump says, I don't know who you're talking about. Well, that's not true. He remembers the moment, as so many do. In case you forgot, here is what Trump said at that infamous rally.
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? Do you know what I'm talking about?
That soundbite has lived over and over and over again. The president himself, of course, has seen it many times. That man, Gregory Cheadle. That's his real name. He is out front. He's also an independent running for Congress in California's 1st Congressional District. And Gregory, look, I really appreciate your time and thank you for coming back. And I want you to be able to explain your reasons for, you know, why you've changed your mind about Trump and the Republican Party. But first, you know, he was just asked about you and the news that you were no longer supporting him. And he tried to blow it off. I don't know who you're talking about. Doesn't know who you are. Do you believe him?
No. You know, I sent correspondence to President Trump. He responded. So to say he doesn't know who I am, that's not correct.
That's amazing. So he actually corresponded with you after that moment, at the rally.
Yeah, I sent him a letter regarding an issue, and he responded, wrote me back.
So look. He obviously knows exactly who you are.
Without a doubt.
When you pointed him out, I'm sorry, Yeah, when he pointed you out, you stood by him. You came on the show, and you and I talked about it. And you
were
pretty direct, Gregory. You said, look, I'm not offended. It was just a fun thing that happened. You took it lightly. You know, and that was 3 years ago, right? About June, I believe, of 2016.
Right.
So
yeah,
what has changed now that changed your mind about him?
Well, you know, when I went to his inauguration, I was hoping against hope that the humility that I saw during his speech would continue. But as time went on, that wasn't the case. There have been just tremendous things that happened that offended me personally. And I'm just sick and tired of the way blacks and other people of color have been treated by this administration and by the GOP, period. The Kaepernick incident was, you know, taking a knee was the major thing for me. I could not understand how in the world the Republicans could be so adamantly opposed to this man trying to get attention to the cause of the plight of blacks. I couldn't understand it.
And I know you also mentioned the way he handled Baltimore was deeply troubling to you, and he's actually there tonight. That's why I bring it up, Gregory, that when he made those comments about you on the White House lawn,
right.
He was on his way to Baltimore. So he's there as we speak. And, of course, it's the
right.
first time he's been to Baltimore since he said that Congressman Cummings' district is a disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess. That's the quote, right,
right.
that he said. Why was that moment so important to you? And I know you mentioned Colin Kaepernick, but that moment when he did that tweet on Baltimore, more than other things, like Charlottesville, for example.
Well, you know, with Elijah Cummings, that was, you know, pretty much one of the straws that broke the proverbial camel's back. You know, Elijah Cummings, you know, good person, good politician. But to constantly blame a black person for these things when, in fact, it was the government's programs that are responsible largely for the ghettos that we have today with the VA and the FHA and all the funding that they did, giving loans to whites and home loans and then home improvement loans and then leaving blacks out of it. So it's the government's responsibility, not Elijah Cummings' responsibility, that that district is there in that condition.
So, Gregory, you know, he said when he was talking about you tonight, you know, after he said he doesn't know who you're talking about, he said, we have tremendous African-American support. So the latest poll that we have shows his approval rating among African-Americans is 9%. His disapproval is 86%. Now, perhaps 9% is tremendous.
Well, it is in his case.
For him and the African-American community. I mean, what's your response to him?
Well, again, it's playing with numbers. You know, 9% is tremendous. I'd give him that. That's a lot for him. I don't know that it's really 9%, but assume that it is 9%. That is tremendous support for him. But 9% overall is a paltry sum. You're not going to do much with
9%. Is he a
racist? Yeah, it's hard for me to call him a racist. I much prefer to say that he has a white superiority complex. More so than calling him a racist, because with his white superiority complex, you know, it's reflected in his cabinet, it's reflected in the White House interns, and it's reflected in his judicial appointments.
And,
so to say
and
that
one
he's
thing I want to just ask you, because I know, I'm sorry, I know we have a bit of a delay, Gregory, so I'm sorry to talk over you, but I'll just finish my question. You know, when you told me
okay.
the last time we spoke, which was after when he called you my African-American, and, you know, you
right.
said it was lighthearted, and you weren't offended. It was just a fun thing that happened. Now that you see him as a pro-white, white supremacy agenda, do you hear what he said about you differently?
Well, I question... Now, I mean, back then it was a joke. It was funny because everyone around me was laughing because I was just being a jokester that day. But, you know, in retrospect, giving him the benefit of the doubt, I just question what he was thinking when he made that statement. I don't know his heart, so it's difficult for me to call him a racist.
Right, but at that moment, you know, it's my African-American feels more negative to you now than lighthearted.
Well, the whole thing feels more negative to me right now than back then, because the weight of being called an African-American by him, it's taken on so much. All of the flack that I got afterwards has just been, it let me know, it was the pulse of the country, how people just were just so fed up. And like I am right now, I'm just fed up with the Republican Party and the way they treat blacks. You know, we have been denied opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. They would rather build jails and prisons than schools. And so that has got to change if this country is going to progress and become, quote unquote, great again.
All right. Well, Gregory, I appreciate your time. I'm glad to speak to you again. And thank you for coming on tonight.
Oh, thank you, Aaron. Thank you so much.
And next, Beto Julian speaking to a hometown crowd tonight. Could tonight give them the breakout that they need? And debate organizers this evening with a message for the candidates. Watch your mouth.
This is
so f***ing proud.
And I was like, yeah, what the f***?
In just moments, 10 candidates will be facing off in the third Democratic presidential debate here in Houston. This is the first time Joe Biden will share the stage with both of his progressive rivals, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But there is a lot more at stake for all the other faces on that screen out front now. Estead Herndon, national political reporter for The New York Times, and Ryan Lizza, chief Washington correspondent for Politico. So Estead, you write in your latest piece that Kamala Harris, you know, she feels this real need and an urgent need to recapture that momentum, the famous momentum from the, you know, calling Joe Biden out for his position on busing. When you look at our polling, she's had a tumultuous summer, right? She spiked. And then she came down much lower than she was even before that. So what's she going to do tonight?
I mean, it's funny. The biggest rally of this campaign, the biggest moment of this campaign has both belonged to Kamala Harris, and she's not been able to translate that into a sustained momentum. They think that this night is critical. After Labor Day, they view people as tuning in, kind of regular, non-kind of party activist voters. They think this is their time to kind of pull folks from Biden. I think she's going to try to find a wedge between those top three candidates. She's going to try to pitch herself as a alternative to Joe Biden in terms of a pragmatic force, but she's tried to cast Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren as kind of elite candidates, ones who don't have the ability to reach a diverse coalition, ones that use what she told to me as ideological and intellectual debates and not what actually moves people in the day-to-day kind of on-the-ground level. So a kind of Biden pragmatic pitch coupled with her identity, coupled with her kind of unique personal story.
And there's a lot of people who are looking for a breakout moment, right? They got to get fundraising by the end of the quarter here, and then, okay, they've made the October debate, but kind of so what if you don't start to move up sharply here?
One of the things I've been talking to the last few days with a lot of campaigns is what was the lesson of Kamala's moment in that debate? It's one of the only things that's really happened in this campaign. It was probably one of the most interesting episodes, but, you know, from the Biden perspective, they'll tell you, well, you know, that goes to show, you know, you can't go after Joe Biden, you pay a price. Kamala went up in the polls and then, you know, she settled back down or even below. So I think all the other campaigns have looked at that and said, all right, how do you go after Biden but have it stick? First thing is you have to do it subtly because Biden himself is very well liked by Democrats. So if it's really too tough and obnoxious, that could backfire.
You don't want to look mean or you don't want to make him look.
Yeah, because people like the guy. That's very hard. And then the second part is you have to have a post-debate strategy. It has to play into some message and larger theme about why you're the candidate. So things I would be looking for is, you know, someone like, do people take on Biden's bond with Obama? Do they take on any of the big legislation of the Obama era and the Obama-Biden record? Does Castro go back and talk about, you know, their sort of spotty checkered record on immigration?
Right.
Does Klobuchar, go after Biden on any of that? She has not been, you know, she really has been very, very, very hard to get her to say anything bad about Joe Biden.
Right. Well, she sort of has positioned herself kind of as the person who could rise if he fails.
Exactly.
If you're trying to take the same spot, you can't poop all over the spot.
Exactly.
What about Beto, Julian Castro, Julian Castro? They both have to break out. They're both, we're holding rallies. This is their home state.
Right.
This is a big night for them.
It is. And we saw them kind of go at it in the first debate, specifically on the question of immigration. It's going to, we're going to see kind of the new Beto. After the tragic El Paso shooting, he's kind of reformed his campaign into this kind of freewheeling, I'm going to say anything, I'm going to do anything approach, a kind of morally driven campaign. He's going to try to bring that through tonight. I would look for that. And then Castro, he still, again, is that candidate that does have a unique personal story to tell, and I think he's going to try to use that in combo with immigration to make his
mark. And then super quickly, the guy who I still see more people wearing, sporting attire of is Andrew Yang.
Andrew Yang is going to talk about one thing, which is his plan to give everyone $1,000 a month, which is the thing that's broken through probably more than any other policy proposal, because he's such a good communicator and is so disciplined about telling that story.
And people wear his hats and wear his shirts. I mean, I know there's some other people on that stage that wish they could have that kind of passion. Yeah. Thank you both. And out front, Jeannie, next.
Debate organizers may not care whether candidates swear off this kind of swearing.
I wrote the damn bill, and they've been laughing their asses off.
But TV networks don't laugh at F-bombs.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Beto O'Rourke may think it's okay for his then 10-year-old daughter's ears.
And I was like, yeah, what the f***? I mean, I'm running for...
But ABC told the campaigns, we will not be broadcasting on any delay, so there will be no opportunity to edit out foul language. Candidates should therefore avoid cursing or expletives in accordance with federal law and FCC guidelines. That means you, Beto. Back in March, a voter made him promise.
We already have one vulgar in chief. Do we need to replace him with another? Come on, Beto, clean up your act, honestly.
Yeah, no, great point, and I don't intend to use the F word going forward.
But fast forward through several mass shootings, and an impassioned O'Rourke let the F-bombs fall where they may.
But we do know this is up.
So, yes, this is up.
Now, President Trump's crowds cheer when he pronounces BS.
With ridiculous bull.
But the F word is like BS on steroids.
And Beto O'Rourke isn't just saying it. He wants you to wear it.
His website sells a T-shirt that repeats the phrase six times, with all proceeds going to two anti-gun violence organizations. His supporters defend him, posting pearls. In case of Beto swearing, break glass and clutch.
And if you think that's bad, you should see his new campaign slogan, Beto mother... O'Rourke, bold leadership for a brighter damn future, ass.
But if those who favor decorum and class have their way,
Biden better watch his malarkeys and his Jiminy Christmases.
How many malarkeys does it take to equal an F-bomb?
Malarkey.
Genimos.
It's a bunch of malarkey.
CNN.
That's so much malarkey.
New York.
I'm running for...
Thanks for watching. Anderson starts now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.